Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the multi-billion-dollar effort to restore the San Joaquin River has hit more than a few snags. We'll hear a report on just what the obstacles are. We'll also get the latest on why the governor wants to use the state's greenhouse gas account to pay for high-speed rail, and the story of one California teen who has helped inspire the state's new transgender students law. And later in today's show, a talk with Randy Poe, the co-author of Buckham, the new posthumous autobiography of Bakersfield's Buck Owens. He's gone through hundreds of tapes made by the late country music icon to give us new insights into the life of one of the most influential musicians in California history. That and much more, all coming up on Valley Edition. But first, the news.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. Environmental groups are reacting to the possibility that California Governor Jerry Brown's budget may propose using cap-and-trade revenue for high-speed rail. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, the state has generated $530 million from the Greenhouse Gas Emissions Reduction Program.
Environmentalists are split on whether the money raised from carbon auctions should be used for high-speed rail. Governor Brown, who will release his proposed budget Friday, has pitched the $68 billion rail project as an environmentally friendly alternative to cars. Dan Jacobson with Environment California agrees.
I think it's a good idea because what we need to move toward is electrifying the transportation system as a whole and being able to reduce the amount of carbon that goes into moving us from point A to point B is what high-speed rail does.
But the governor upset environmentalists last year by taking a $500 million loan from cap-and-trade revenues to balance the state's books. Some environmental groups say high-speed rail is an inappropriate use of funds. They say that money should be used on projects that will reduce greenhouse gases now. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
The California legislature is back in session and Democrats remain firmly in control. As Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, leaders are starting the year with a focus on the economy.
Democratic leaders are pushing a message of restoring the state's economy by creating a rainy day fund and paying down debt. But projects like high-speed rail and the Delta Water Tunnel Plan could put pressure on the budget. Democrats hold a supermajority in the legislature, but Senate Majority Leader Ellen Corbett says the party will continue to act responsibly.
We're going to spend where we need to spend to foster growth in this economy. It's up to us, in a way, to continue to grow ourselves out of the recession. And like I said, we still have a ways to go, so I think we will be very responsible.
The party will also be facing a change in leadership in the coming months. Both the Assembly Speaker and Senate President are being termed out, and the speculation has already begun over who will replace them. At the State Capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
A new Fresno County jail project is likely to gain support today from Fresno County supervisors. If the county agrees to set aside $8.8 million, it will be awarded $79.2 million for the project. County supervisors voted unanimously in October to find state money to build a 300-bed jail in downtown Fresno. The new jail will replace the existing South Annex jail that sleeps 499, 199 more than the new jail. The Board of State and Community Corrections is expected next week to approve counties that will receive money. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. It's been almost 8 years since the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation began its program to restore the San Joaquin River. In the 1940s, Fryant Dam and irrigation diversion dried up 60 miles of California's second largest river. Historic salmon runs disappeared. This month is the deadline for the program to restore enough water to the San Joaquin to eventually allow runs of Chinook salmon. But as Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, the restoration program has been plagued by delays and increased costs.
I'm following fish biologists with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation into the cold waters of the San Joaquin River near its confluence with the Merced River. I'm wearing waders for good reason.
Yeah, right here is about waist deep.
The biologists are checking nets they've placed in the river for salmon.
Oh, look.
Yeah, we do have a salmon in the net.
It's near the end of the season for fall run Chinook, so they catch just two. Salmon sometimes manage to make it through a fish barrier here. If they do, biologist Chuck Hewitt says they face certain death.
There's a section in the middle where it's dry, so the salmon can't make it up that far.
We got 43.
Biologists tag and measure the salmon. Because the river runs dry, they truck the salmon upriver and release them near Fresno. Before the Friant Dam was built, tens of thousands of salmon spawned in the San Joaquin. The goal of the San Joaquin River Restoration Program is to bring back the river and the fish. It's the result of a 2006 legal settlement involving environmentalists, the Bureau of Reclamation, and farmers who get their water from the Friant operation. Monty Schmidt is a scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
What we're taking on is quite a substantial effort. The largest river restoration project for certain in California, and surely probably one of the largest in U.S. history.
No one expected immediate results, but after 8 years and $100 million, the river still runs dry. Major channel improvements, including fish screens, were supposed to be completed by the end of 2013.
They haven't turned one shovel of dirt on this entire system.
Cannon Michael stands in front of a dry river channel choked with shrubs and trees.
There's nothing that's been even started physically, and so that's where we are saying, you know, now you're missing your own deadlines, let's figure out some other kind of a plan that makes sense for everybody.
Michael and his father-in-law, Jim Nickel, farm near the river. Nickel's farmland was damaged when the restoration program released test flows down the old channel in 2009. Groundwater seeped into his crops.
Yes, that was the mighty San Joaquin River. It's sad, but let's be realistic. You can't replace some things. You can't go back. You know, there's a money issue. It's just a reality issue. It just doesn't work.
Both Michael and Nickel say the restoration project lacks money. Nickel says they've grown frustrated with the delays.
It's costing me probably $100,000 a year just for personnel, engineers, attorneys. We go to meetings once or twice a month. It was more than that, and we spent all this time.
The Bureau of Reclamation did reimburse Nickel for the damages. Alicia Forsyth, program manager for the restoration program, says many of the delays were unavoidable. The recession hit just as the project was beginning. Water seepage stalled projects. The land is sinking in an area where a new fish screen is needed.
The settlement assumed that those projects would begin immediately, that there would be willing access from all landowners, that basically everything was going to fall perfectly in line for these projects. And we find that that's just not reality.
The problems and delays have escalated costs. The program's original estimate was between $250 million and $800 million. Now Forsyth says it's closer to $1 billion. She says the schedule for the projects will be revised again based on priority and what she calls more realistic funding. Scott West says it may be a frustrating wait, but it's worth it. He's president of Fresno Fly Fishers for Conservation. Despite that title, he says being able to fish for salmon once again in the San Joaquin isn't his primary desire.
I don't believe in giving up on that river. You know, I'd like to see us, you know, fix a past wrong.
The Bureau of Reclamation is hopeful that the San Joaquin River will be reconnected in 2014. Barriers would still prevent adult salmon from making it up and down the river. But for the first time in 60 years, endangered spring run Chinook salmon will be reintroduced into the river. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 2013 marked California's driest calendar year on record. And as anyone who's taken a drive into the Sierra lately can tell you, the lack of snow is frankly alarming. Of course, it's a huge concern to water users from cities to farmers here in the valley, as it would mark the third dry year in a row if the drought continues. Forecasters who are normally known for their sober language are using words like historic, stunning, and mind-boggling to describe the current situation. To learn more about the current drought and the prospect for the future, We're joined by one of the Valley's top independent meteorologists, Steve Johnson. He is the owner of Steve Johnson & Associates, Atmospherics Group International. Steve, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you.
I understand going back last year, last fall, you actually predicted this and what's going on right now.
Yes.
Not a happy prediction, but...
No, it was not. I would add one more word to your list of words that we're using, and that is the word unprecedented.
And putting this in context to what we've seen in the past, calling it unprecedented, we've had dry years before, we've had droughts before, we've had 2-3 year droughts before. 1976 and 77, for many of our listeners, they may remember that. How does this year compare? Because that's always been the year that people tout as, well, that was the driest ever. How does this compare to that?
I certainly remember 76 because I was alive and at a young age. I remember it very well because it had a direct impact on my life and my family's life because they're farmers. And I remember on Christmas Day in 76 wearing shorts. And I also remember the Midwest on those 76, 77 years experiencing cold weather very close to what they're experiencing today and yesterday. And it's similar in some respects, but the drought in the calendar year 2013 is unprecedented.
And usually we talk about water year droughts, basically a winter of 2012, 2013, but the whole calendar year of 2013 last year was remarkably dry. Is it this that something is persisting? What exactly is going on? Not to get too technical, but obviously something is out of the normal from what we usually have here. Is it high pressure? What's happening?
The high pressure that we normally have is in meteorological terms called the Hawaiian high pressure cell. In the wintertime, usually it retracts back toward Hawaii. In the summer, it amplifies and intensifies, moves toward the southwest United States, and then we have our summertime. It has not retracted as it should have, and it is producing record high temperatures, record cold temperatures, record dryness. And last year, it was unrelenting and very, very resilient. Every time a trough would knock it down, it would quickly rebuild up. And that really came to light during November of 2013. And then it really exploded during December.
Now, is this connected with we had in December that cold snap that came
yes.
through that caused the citrus growers
yes.
so much concern and so
yes.
much damage?
Yes.
Now you have the polar vortex back east that's causing so many things. Are all of these things all related to that one
yes.
issue?
Yes. There's a very high correlation between droughts and freezes, unfortunately. And I sympathize with the citrus growers in the valley because I have spent the last 30-some-odd days on frost patrol, doing frost forecasts for these poor farmers who have been trying to save their crop. The Arctic push down into the California first appeared on the charts on the 24th of November, and I held back a day or so before I made an announcement to our clients that on that Monday, the 25th of November, that they should start seriously considering an Arctic push reaching into California. And 10 days later, it occurred. It occurred very early in the season for citrus.
Yeah, usually we have those in late December, early January, those cold snaps.
Correct. And the last time that we had such severity was for an extended period of time was back in 1998.
Yeah, that was a bad freeze. I remember that year.
Very bad. And those appeared during Christmas week. This appeared the first week of December. So a lot of the fruit had not been harvested. It had not sweetened up enough for them to pick. And it left a lot of fruit on the trees vulnerable.
Yeah, certainly a very serious situation for a big segment of the Valley's ag economy. Turning back to the lack of precipitation, these dry years, do they usually come in groups of two, three like this? I guess this would be the third year in a dry cycle. How does that work? Are these grouped in some way?
Yes, they are. We discovered that about a dozen years ago, that there is a very high correlation. When you get down into the 10 or 15 percentile of the lowest precipitation years, they're highly correlated with multi-year droughts. And having a back-to-back drought year, as we have had, and looking at going into a third year of drought, is not all that uncommon, because droughts are a normal variant of climate in all zones across the globe.
Yeah, certainly. Let's turn to looking forward and the forecast moving ahead. When we talk about spells like this and everyone sees extreme weather, whether it's extreme hot or extreme cold, immediately the issue of climate change comes up. And people ask, is this a result of climate change? And I understand you've been seeing some things that have caused you alarm, both with this drought and also with some of the record temperatures we've had in the summer in recent years along those lines. Does this have anything to do, in your opinion, with climate change?
It may. All I can tell you is that in the past year or two, or longer than that, actually, the ratio, when I'm doing a forecast, part of the one segment of the forecast that I like to put in each one is a segment that I call record high temps, or just record temps anywhere in California. What kind of records were set in the state of California on that particular day? And what I've noticed is the ratio of hotter records versus the ratio of colder records is much higher in hotter records. It's about a 5-to-1 ratio.
And we've seen record high temperatures even in places like Death Valley, numerous new records being set recently.
Death Valley is the canary in the coal mine, in my opinion. The number of times that I wrote new record high temperatures last year in Death Valley actually stunned me, because I think I wrote at least five, perhaps six record high temperatures last year, daily high temperatures records for Death Valley last year.
We're talking with Steve Johnson. He's the owner of Steve Johnson and Associates. He's one of the Valley's top independent meteorologists. A lot of farmers and water districts and folks like that employ his services to give an independent look at the forecast for precipitation and temperatures high and low here in one of the richest ag lands in the world. What are you hearing, the concerns from your clients right now? I imagine there's, you know, concern is to put it mildly at this point. We saw late last year a 5% allocation announced. I think it for the State Water Project users, there's some concern whether that even that number can be reached at this point.
That is a major concern. And the farmers and ranchers in the San Joaquin Valley are keenly aware of the lack of water and the lack of snowpack, and they're watching the evapotranspiration rates soar during these warm days that we've been having the past month, with record high afternoon temperatures and then flipping into record low temperatures sometimes at night. Because of the dryness of the air, there's actually not enough moisture in the air for our famous valley fog regime. Even though the computer models for the practically the whole month of December were calling for fog to form in the valley, it just couldn't happen because there's not enough moisture in the soil, in the air itself, for fog to form. So that's kind of an interesting twerk.
So with the water situation that we have right now, obviously it's bone dry out there. The first snow survey of the year came out last Friday and in some cases found more dirt than snow. The concern right now is, even if the forecast changes, and we'll talk about what the future holds in just a moment, but even if it does, we're in a really big hole right now, are we not?
We are in the biggest hole in the history of recorded history of California. The precept numbers that came out for the annual calendar year of 2013 were stunning. When I started compiling the list in the whole, for the whole state of California on New Year's Eve, I was awake until 4 o'clock that next morning because the list was a lot more extensive than I had anticipated. And with each line that I typed out, I had more and more adrenaline pumped into me that kept me awake all night long because I kept saying, wow, holy cow, oh my goodness. And that was with each line that I was typing. And because the numbers that came out absolutely, totally obliterated the old 1976 or the 1929 or the 1917, all these famous droughts that California has had, it not only beat them, it smashed them. It obliterated the previous records by as much as 40%.
Wow.
50%, 60%. And the highest one at Ben Lomond Station near Santa Cruz, it beat it was 14, almost 14 inches short of the prior 1976 record.
14 inches less than the previous record
low.
Yes,
yes.
Wow.
Yes. They had 20.45 inches in 76 and last year 6.5. So that's a 68% drop from the prior drought year. I mean, it's unprecedented. It's unbelievable.
Very sobering numbers. Let's look ahead now. Forecasts that you look at very long term, and then you have a sort of 16-day window. What are we seeing as we start this new year? We're a week in so far. What are we seeing later in January, February, and maybe even into March?
Okay. The first thing I want to do in that category is unfortunately, your listeners cannot see what I'm handing you, but I'm handing you a global chart showing the sea surface temperature anomalies for the entire globe. And you tell me what is the one thing that points out like a sore thumb.
There is a big red spot in the North Pacific.
In the Gulf of Alaska.
Yeah.
That spot signifies a +3 standard deviation anomaly for
I have no idea what that means.
Sea surface temperatures. It means that
it's warm.
It's warmer than average.
Okay.
Then an anomaly is the degree above or below average. And it's quite large. There's nothing else on the globe that even comes close to comparing to it. And
is that good news or bad news?
Well, for our drought, it's bad news because now I'm going to trade you and show you this line. Do you see where I've drawn the red line?
A line going from the southern coast of Japan straight across north of the Hawaiian Islands and then up to about Vancouver, BC.
Right. Because the jet stream this entire winter has followed that path, the teleconnection between the cooler than average temperatures to the south of that line versus the warmer temperatures to the north of it is where the jet stream wants to go. And so
it's bypassing California.
It's bypassing California because we have cooler temperatures right next to the west coast, which is forcing the jet stream to curve northward toward British Columbia, and then it slides down south. So it is directly related to two different things. One, it's creating the drought in the west. And number two, it's creating the incredibly low temperatures in the east, eastern portion of the nation.
Well, all of this doesn't sound too encouraging at this point. Is there any cause for hope at this point?
Okay.
We just have about a minute left.
Okay. We compiled several different indices and came up with a couple of real quick numbers. And it looks like unless we receive epic-type biblical rainfall, that California is going to experience perhaps its driest year in history. There's always room for hope. I'm eternally optimistic. And as a farmer and rancher's son, I know the value of water. So at any opportunity, I'm looking for a silver lining in the horizon. What we do see happening out there on days 14, 15, or 16 is perhaps...
And this is 14, 15, 16 days from today.
Correct, which would put it around the 20th of January, 21st, or 22nd, sometime in that time period. It looks like the jet stream that has been diverted over and over the top of us will finally punch through the high-pressure ridge and shove it into the Great Basin, and then we are given the opportunity for having some rainfall. It doesn't look like it's going to be a lot at this time today. It did. It looked a little better last night, and then I took a quick look at the charts before I left this morning, and it's backing off just a little bit. But again, we remain eternally optimistic and hopeful that things turn around. It's not an easy job watching a lot of pain inflicted on your friends and family.
Well, and if this persists, it's going to be pain inflicted on all of us in California. Steve Johnson, our guest today on Valley Edition. He is an independent meteorologist, one of the top ones in the Valley, client to many of the Valley's water districts and growers. And we're talking about the drought. We hope that prediction of some rainfall in a few weeks holds out. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned on Valley Edition. We'll be back in just a moment with more and hear about the story of a teen who helped inspire California's new transgender schools law and find out about the latest on high-speed rail and more. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Beginning this month, all California public school districts must allow transgender students to use facilities and play on sports teams according to which gender they identify with. Supporters say the law will protect a vulnerable group of students, but opponents think voters should have a say, and petition signatures are still being validated for an effort to put a referendum on the November ballot. Katie Orr reports on the controversy and brings us the story of one California teen who worked to help pass the law.
High school junior Ashton Lee hustles between after-school activities. First, he makes a stop at the Gay-Straight Alliance. There, as club president, he leads a discussion on how to handle holiday stress.
Yes, you can have your stress. I'll have mine. There you go.
Less than an hour later, he's speed walking across campus, hoping he's not too late for junior ROTC practice.
Is practice still going on?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
He's in time.
Color guard,
and he falls in line and begins marching up and down the field with his squad.
Left, right,
forward,
left.
In many ways, Ashton is a regular kid, but at 16, he's also dealing with a pretty adult situation. Ashton is transgender and has become the face of a new state law that requires public schools to let transgender students use bathrooms and locker rooms and to play on sports teams according to which gender they identify with, regardless of their biological sex. Before the law was passed, Ashton testified in front of the state legislature and delivered petitions to Governor Jerry Brown's office urging him to sign the legislation.
I knew what had to be done, and I knew that somebody had to do it.
Ashton knows he's fortunate. His parents and friends were supportive when he came out as transgender last year, and his school has worked with him to make sure he's comfortable and safe. For instance, Ashton is now allowed to use the boys' restroom, which is a big victory after 2 years of just trying to avoid the school bathroom altogether.
It's easier to be uncomfortable than to have to be afraid if you're going to be hurt or if you're going to be in trouble.
Researcher Emily Graytak says Ashton's earlier experiences mirror those of other transgender kids. Two-thirds say they regularly feel unsafe at school. Graytak is with the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network and studies transgender youth. She says school can be a hostile and unwelcoming place for those kids who, as a result, often underperform academically.
The harassment and assault that they experience really limits not only their access to education at the moment, but also their access to future educational and vocational opportunities.
Graytak says bathrooms and locker rooms are especially dangerous for transgender students. She says inclusive policies can be helpful if they're implemented correctly. But critics say the new California law is inadequate. It doesn't clearly explain how districts should accommodate transgender students, just that they should. Brad Dacus is president of the Pacific Justice Institute, a conservative legal organization that handles religious-based cases. The institute opposes the law and is working to get the issue on next year's ballot. Dacus says the measure puts the privacy of other students at risk and could leave school districts open to lawsuits.
It's a huge farce and misnomer for us to think for one moment that girls are not going to be uncomfortable if a biological boy, who they know is a biological boy, comes into their bathroom while they're using the bathroom facilities.
Dacus says the state law could actually hurt transgender kids because it doesn't require schools, counselors, and parents to develop specific plans for transgender students. He says his organization will keep working to overturn the law. But similar policies may already be taking hold locally around California. Several school districts already have transgender student guidelines in place, and in 2012, the California Interscholastic Federation, which oversees high school sports, ruled students should have the opportunity to participate in CIF activities according to their gender identity. For Ashton, the outcome of such policies is clear.
I'm way more comfortable at school. I feel safer. I don't have to worry. I can be who I am without having to worry about any repercussions. And it's the best thing since sliced bread.
At the State Capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For football fans, January is truly the most wonderful time of the year. The month began with the Rose Bowl, continued last night with the BCS National Championship, and comes to a close with the NFL playoffs in the road to the Super Bowl. But recently, a series of events have brought new scrutiny to what some are calling the dark side of the sport. In this edition of Valley Public Radio's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Communication Professor Diane Blair says that in light of these incidents, it's time to reevaluate our views on masculinity.
Like many Americans, I'm an avid football fan, and this is a great time of year for football fans. Increasingly, however, I find myself troubled by the persistent evidence that this beloved American pastime is promoting a toxic form of violent masculinity. As such, I find myself experiencing significant levels of cognitive dissonance as I cheer on my favorite teams. Football is not just a game. It is a persuasive and powerful cultural institution. And while the type of masculinity promoted by our football culture is hardly the only source of such definitions of manhood, it is a prominent one. Consider the recent revelations of bullying in the Miami Dolphin locker room. Jonathan Martin, a biracial offensive lineman, left the team after constant harassment from his white teammate, Richie Incognito. There are two aspects to this case that reveal a larger culture of toxic masculinity. First, there is the racist and sexist language Incognito used to harass Martin. Incognito defended himself by suggesting that the feminization of opponents, homophobic slurs, and threats of violence are common in NFL locker rooms. The second revealing aspect of this situation was the outpouring of support towards Incognito by fellow teammates and some prominent sports commentators, along with the tendency to blame Martin for either not understanding locker room culture or needing to just man up. These responses are supported by a long-held cultural belief that being a man is limited to certain expressions of strength and power. Showing fear, vulnerability, or feelings is associated with weakness, being a wuss, and acting like a girl. This dominant version of supposed manliness positions anything feminine, anything associated with women, as inferior and threatening to one's manhood. As such, women are often the targets of this toxic masculinity. This toxic masculinity was apparent in the Steubenville, Ohio case, where two high school boys sexually assaulted an unconscious teenage girl while others looked on and even recorded the abuse on their cell phones. The violence done to the young victim was born out of the boys' belief that sexually dominating a helpless girl made them powerful and cool to their peers. and also that there would be no consequences for them because of their status as popular star athletes. But there are consequences for men trying to live up to this man code. Men are far more likely to be both perpetrators and victims of violence. They have higher rates of alcohol and drug abuse and higher rates of suicide. All of us are harmed by the normalization of this toxic masculinity. As a culture, we are long overdue for a wider range of performances and acceptance for what it means to be a man. For The Moral Is, this is Diane Blair.
This is Valley Edition. California's $68 billion high-speed rail project ran into a rough stretch of track late last year with court rulings that cast serious doubt about the project's business plan and construction timeline. Now, with the start of the new year and Governor Brown's new budget about to be released later this week in advance of his State of the State address, we thought we'd take a look at just where the project stands right now. Joining us to talk about the bullet train is reporter Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee. He's been covering high-speed rail for several years now. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
News broke this past weekend about Governor Brown's plan to use money from the state's cap-and-trade carbon offset fee system for high-speed rail. This itself isn't new. It was first raised back in early 2012 when the Rail Authority revised its business plan.
Right.
But back then, people in Sacramento were calling it a backstop, sort of a last resort. What's changed, and what does this really mean when we're talking about cap-and-trade and high-speed rail?
Well, it's gone now. It seems to be going now from being a backstop to being plan A. A lot of that is predicated upon the continued reluctance of a Republican-controlled Congress to allocate any more money toward this. Another piece of it also is, I think, some of the bond rulings that were made late last year that you referred to, the judge's ruling that the state can't use any of the bond funds until they accomplish certain other pieces that they need to do that they hadn't done so far.
Now, there are various voices out there. Some are big supporters of the AB 32 protocol that are raising some questions. There are some who are opponents of high-speed rail entirely. They are also raising questions about this and have been since it first was broached in 2012, mm-hmm. that the whole point of AB 32 was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by the year 2020 mm-hmm. by establishing a market for CO2 emissions, CO2 credits. Mm-hmm. Big polluters would have a cap on their emissions. If they wanted to pollute more than that, what they would buy credits on the market.
Right.
Many critics, though, have pointed out that with using that money for high-speed rail, there's a problem in that the first big stretch from Merced to Southern California isn't going to be actually operational until 2022 at the earliest.
Right.
Is that something that is also being discussed? Is that an issue of contention?
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it will be, too. If nothing else, it's likely to be a source of litigation at some point. If the governor does indeed propose that and the legislature moves toward it, then it could very well be a source of litigation. It could also very well be a source of contention within the legislature itself. Because if we recall, when the legislature approved the initial appropriation of money for high-speed rail, it was a one-vote margin. And so I think that particular question could very well arise in the debates over the budget.
Back when the issue first came to California voters in 2008, one of the things that supporters of high-speed rail said was, well, we're going to ask the voters of California for this money in a bond measure. We're going to get federal money, but we're also going to have private support.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard a lot about that private support, what the plan is to getting that private investment into this system in some time, really since this new business plan was released in early 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that stand? Is that still in the cards for high-speed rail? Are they still counting on that moving forward?
It's still in the business plan. I think they're still counting on it. I think the form of it is – remains a huge question mark for what form that private investment would take. In conversations I've had with high-speed rail folks, they have talked about the prospect of generating private revenue through leasing right-of-way for such things as communication corridors, fiber optics, things like that, which were part of the picture in Spain's high-speed rail. I think they're also anticipating some revenue from franchises. Now, to the extent that that represents investment in the system and seeking any sort of return on that investment, I think you get into a picture of semantics at that point as to whether that represents money coming into the project or whether it simply represents doing business.
We're talking with reporter Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee about California's high-speed rail system. We mentioned a moment ago some rulings came out late last year. I want to talk specifically about the repercussions from the rulings by Superior Court Judge Michael Kenney, who ruled the authority isn't in compliance with the law passed by voters, mainly having all the funding secured before the first stretch of construction and then having environmental approvals done before the construction begins.
Right.
Those were pretty serious issues that came up.
Oh, definitely.
Judge Kenney's courtroom. Where does the Rail Authority stand at addressing those?
At this point, the Rail Authority says that it is trying to address them. They anticipate trying to come up with a new funding plan, which was the part that that Judge Kenney found deficient. I think they're trying to get something along those lines resubmitted early this year. Now, what is early this year? That's anybody's guess, because timelines on this project seem to shift as moment to moment. Presumably, this cap and trade proposal that the governor may be making in his budget may be part of the source of that funding that they would be identifying. The other piece in terms of the environmental compliance, that is going to be another major chunk, and I'm not quite sure how they're going to overcome that, because so far we still only have Merced to Fresno as the only certified environmental clearance. And that's absent a chunk around the Chowchilla area where there would be a junction for a branch to head off toward the San Jose area. There's still Fresno to Bakersfield that has to be done. There's still Bakersfield to Palmdale and Palmdale to the San Fernando Valley. These things do not happen quickly, these certifications and these environmental impact reports. So I think that probably remains the biggest stumbling block if the judge holds tight to his reliance that he's had in the past on the plain language of Proposition 1A, which seemed to require those environmental certifications before they can move forward with spending any bond funds.
The next issue that's before a judge is this issue about whether the current blended approach that the Rail Authority is planning, using some existing rail tracks in Southern and Northern California, upgrading them for high-speed rail and merging them with the new track that's being built in the valley, whether this can actually meet the mandate that voters approved in 2008 that the trip from LA to San Francisco takes 2 hours and 40 minutes or no more than that.
Right.
What are you hearing on that front? Is this something that is subject to interpretation, or is this kind of a hard and fast thing that black and white, there is a way?
I think it's going to be subject to interpretation. It's impossible to prove a negative, but you can have your experts take a best guess at it. And what the plaintiffs from Kings County in this lawsuit have put forth a cadre of experts that basically all say it can't be done. And you've had the Rail Authority, which has basically said, yes, it can, but they haven't put out a whole lot of expertise in terms of the court briefs so far. So it's going to be interesting to see if and when this piece comes to trial, how it goes. So it's going to be whose experts are more credible in that.
You talk to people on both sides of this issue, from the folks in Kings County who are leading this fight against the Rail Authority to backers of the project and the Rail Authority folks themselves. What's your take on the temperature of the situation right now? Did the rulings embolden the project opponents?
Oh, definitely. The project opponents have seized upon these rulings as major stumbling blocks, as crucial hits to the program. The project opponents have said, we can deal with it. We can handle this. It's not a big deal. And some of the critics have said they're whistling past the graveyard in terms of this, whether it's denial or whether it's perpetual optimism or whether it's realistic optimism. Yeah, there's always a shot in court that the judge may say, I think it can be done in 2 hours 40. And whether the Rail Authority can come up with plans, a finance plan that passes the judge's muster, they seem confident. The opponents say, we're not confident at all. We don't think they can do it. And to that extent, the opponents are confident that they've got this thing on the ropes.
What about the political temperature of this right now? Are you seeing any shifts there? We are entering an election year. This is always an interesting time to pay attention to politicians' responses to controversial issues. And certainly polls have showed that statewide voters are more skeptical of high-speed rail now than they were, say, a few years ago,
right,
as the price tag has escalated, as other difficulties have come up. Is there a potential for any political shifts here with this issue?
It's times like this that I wish I was closer tied into Sacramento, that I wish I was up in Sacramento reporting instead of down here in Fresno. You get the sense from listening to from reading the accounts of legislators who were interviewed on this subject by other reporters that there may be a shift. But a lot of the legislators that I've seen interviewed are people that voted against it in the first place. So I've not seen any shifts of people who are supporters yet. That's not to say that we won't see that, because this is a hot political potato, and hot political potatoes can get even hotter in an election year.
Before we go, the issue of groundbreaking and timelines comes up again. If we had this conversation, I think we did about a year ago.
We did, yes.
We were talking about having a groundbreaking sometime in summer of 2013, and then that got pushed off into the fall or late in the year.
Exactly.
And then it was most recently at the end of last year, we were told, well, January or February, there will probably be some groundbreaking ceremony taking place. Is that now in doubt?
It seems to be, because every time I ask the rail authority folks, when are we going to have a groundbreaking, they just kind of – they dodge the question now. What the line is now out of the rail authority in Sacramento is, well, there's a lot of behind-the-scenes work going on. We've got things going to get ready for actual construction. For instance, last month there was an engineering company that was doing soil borings here in Fresno, basically testing the structure of the soil in key areas where new structures would be. The rail authority points to that as tangible evidence, not necessarily construction, but tangible work that's going on to advance toward. We also see what seem to be baby steps toward the acquisition of property. Last month, the rail authority went to the Public Works Board up in Sacramento, and the Public Works Board authorized the use of eminent domain to acquire the first piece of property here in the Fresno area that is not a willing seller. Next week, there is another one, another piece of property on the Public Works Board's agenda. And the rail authority has indicated that it anticipates more of those coming forward as they work through the process of trying to negotiate with owners up and down the route. And as owners don't reach agreement, then those will come to be eminent domain cases.
It was a very interesting story, and it takes more twists and turns for a high-speed rail track. You'd think it would be
indeed
nice and straight, but it's quite windy and curvy.
Indeed.
Again, Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee. He is reporting on the ups and downs of California's high-speed rail project. We'll find out more about the governor's plans later this week when he releases his budget on Friday. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Buck Owens was one of the giants of country music, helping to define a rough-and-ready sound that will forever be linked with the city that Owens called home, Bakersfield. While Owens died in 2006, his legacy lives on. Now a new book titled Buckum, the autobiography of Buck Owens, tells his story. It's by Owens, of course, and our next guest, Grammy-nominated producer and author Randy Poe. Randy, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thanks. Great to be here.
How did this project come about?
Well, I had just written a book, or just had a book published called Sky Dog, the Duane Allman story. And I wanted to follow that up with another biography. And I'm based in L.A., and I went up to Bakersfield and met with some of Buck's family and a gentleman named Jim Shaw, who was the keyboard player in the Buckaroos and very involved in Buck's business enterprises there in Bakersfield. And I met them and talked to them about doing an authorized biography of Buck. And we had a great meeting, and after it was over, they took me into Buck's office, just showing me around. They said, and this was Buck's office for many years, and sitting on his desk were these cassette tapes. And Jim Shaw said, oh, hey, these tapes could be helpful to you in your project. And I said, well, what are they? He said, Well, back in the mid-90s, Buck was thinking about doing his autobiography, and so every now and then he would record stories about his life on these cassettes, and this is them. And I said, yes, that would be extremely helpful. So I started listening to the tapes, and I got to thinking that it would be a different and better kind of book if we were to take the tapes and turn them into Buck's autobiography, which is what he had originally intended. And so I went back to the family and proposed that option rather than the authorized biography. And they said, by all means, if you can pull it off, then go ahead. And I think maybe we did.
Was it challenging to stay true to Owen's voice in working on this project?
No, not at all. I mean, he has a very distinct voice, and he had a way of telling stories that was very unique to him. And much of what's on the pages of the book came straight off of the tapes.
I want to turn to his story now. Like a lot of people who grew up in the Great Depression, Buck knew poverty, and those years left a big imprint on him. Do you think that's part of what drove him in his career, in his business ventures, in his musical ventures?
Absolutely. I think it's what drove his whole life. From the time he was a kid, like you say, I mean, he lived in poverty, and he talks in the book about how he decided when he was very young that he was going to grow up and be somebody, that he wasn't going to live in a world where he had to fix the holes in his shoes with old pieces of linoleum from the kitchen floor, and he wasn't going to have his mother cutting his hair anymore. He wasn't going to have to have hand-me-down clothes and clothes given to him by the local church and those kind of things. He was going to be somebody. He was going to have money. He was going to be successful. Of course, he didn't have a clue how yet or by what means, but that was his intention from the time he was a child.
Things really started taking off for him in the early 1950s when he and his young wife moved to California eventually and settled in Bakersfield. What was that like for him, and do you think Buck would have developed differently had he not gone to Bakersfield?
Well, Bakersfield for him was a place with a musical community that was one where the musicians all seemed to look out for each other. Certainly the way Buck tells it, when he got to town, if he needed a guitar, somebody would loan him a guitar. If he needed a nice shirt to wear at a gig, somebody would loan him the shirt. When his guitar broke, the fiddle player fixed it on the spot in a club there in Bakersfield. And there were musicians like Ferlin Husky and Jeannie Shepherd who became successful, had number one hits, and the other people in Bakersfield, Buck said, rather than feeling jealousy, they were rooting for them because they thought, well, if those two can do it, maybe I can do it too. As far as prior to his moving to Bakersfield, if he'd have stayed somewhere else as a musician around Phoenix, Mesa, Arizona, I think he might have just been a guy playing in a bar band all his life. I think it would probably been something else that he did in addition to whatever he ended up becoming successful at, because he was definitely going to be successful.
The title of the book, Buckham, refers to not only his name, but also his attitude towards the establishment, whether it's the country music establishment or the music industry itself, the way that the business worked, or at least used to work. Buck was an innovator in both of those fields. Talk about his relationship with Nashville and the established country music hegemony of the day. What was that like, and did it change at all over the years, or did he always maintain that, I guess you could say, resentment towards the power brokers in Nashville?
Well, the way that things were based there, you were expected, if you were going to be a country singer, you were expected to live in Nashville, you were expected to record in Nashville, you were expected to sign with the Nashville division of the record label, even if the record label was based in New York or L.A., you were expected to sign with the Nashville music publisher, you were expected to have a booking agent who was based in Nashville, and your personal manager needed to be based in Nashville. And Buck had no interest in any of that. Buck liked being in Bakersfield. Buck got a recording contract with Capitol Records so he could go down to L.A. a couple hours away to record, and then go back up to Bakersfield, which is where his headquarters were. And he had no interest in that whole scene that was going on in Nashville. He wasn't interested in using their studio musicians. He wanted to use his own band, which was just unheard of at that time. And so he did everything his own way. He had his own publishing company, hired his own personal manager to come live in Bakersfield and work. The two of them work out of Bakersfield together. And so everything that Nashville was doing, Buck was doing his own version of it on the other side of the country. And his anger and resentment stemmed from the fact that those power brokers in Nashville therefore concluded he's not really a country singer, because if he was a country singer, he'd be living here doing things the way we tell him to. And so he was ignored by those organizations that were giving out awards to country singers. And it hurt him and it angered him, and he's continually just proved them wrong by having number one hit after number one hit, even though they paid no attention to him.
If you just joined us in Valley Edition, our guest today is Randy Poe. He is the co-author of a new book called Buckum, the autobiography of Buck Owens. It's based on hundreds of hours of recordings that Buck Owens made about his life story. Of course, the musical side of his innovations are well documented, and I think appreciation for them has even grown more since his passing. Buck was also an innovator in his business empire as well, owning radio stations, his publishing company, as you mentioned, really ahead of his time when we think of the way that artists are operating today and seeking more control over their creative output.
Oh, yes, he was decades ahead of his time, for sure. The thing that was most unique that he did was his deal in 1971, I believe it was, where he was able to negotiate a new agreement with Capitol Records, in which when that deal expired, his masters would come back to him, but not just the masters from that particular contract, but all the masters he'd ever recorded for Capitol going all the way back to the 50s. And so today, Buck Owens Enterprises owns all of those master recordings that Buck made for Capitol.
Definitely an innovator there. You mentioned earlier people who grew up watching Buck Owens on television on Hee Haw have a certain image of the man and maybe even of his music, and how that might not be exactly the best image of Buck. You look back on some of those TV shows now and they seem rather corny. Did he reflect back on that decision to stay on Hee Haw and what that meant for his career?
Yes, it was one of those things that he had mixed emotions about. We have to put it in a bit of a perspective, which is when he started, the whole premise was we're going to bring country music to the masses of America who've never heard country music and who've never heard of Buck Owens. So that part was good for Buck. And the negative parts were really obvious really quickly. The first reviews that came out called him a buffoon, which hurt him deeply. But the reason he couldn't pull the plug and say, I'm not going to do this anymore, is because he was getting paid $400,000 a year in 1960s money and 1970s to go down to Nashville for a couple of weeks twice a year and record all of his stuff for the show. And then the show would be edited later to create the 26 episodes for the season. And so it was so little work and such huge money. I mean, we're talking about the equivalent of around $3 million a year today, that he couldn't bring himself to say, no, please stop writing those checks for me.
Moving on to some of his personal relationships, the death of his longtime right-hand man, Don Rich, in the mid-1970s in a tragic motorcycle accident had a profound effect on Buck. Did he ever really get over that? That really changed him, didn't it?
Yeah, it changed him permanently. It's not something he got over. I can sort of understand it, especially when you hear the tapes. This was someone who was about the most important permanent figure in Buck's life. They had known each other since Don was a teenager. And musically, they were a perfect fit. Don's harmony vocals and Don's guitar work, as Buck himself said, was as much as Buck Owens' sound as Buck Owens was. And a few years ago, there was an anthology of Don Rich's work that came out, and Buck wrote a little thing at the beginning of that where he said, just plain as day, I never got over Don's death. He said, I tried to keep going and keep making music, but after he died, the fire was gone. He certainly had his comeback with Dwight Yoakam and made some more recordings, but things were not the same for Buck personally or musically after Don passed away.
Another relationship that Buck talks about in the book is the one that he had with Merle Haggard, a fellow legend of the Bakersfield sound, a complex relationship, though not the least of which with Bonnie Owens, who was first Buck's wife and then later Merle's wife. Tell me about that relationship and what Buck felt towards Merle.
One of the old wives' tales in the country music world was always, hey, you know, Merle stole Buck's wife away from him. And nothing could be further from the truth. Buck and Bonnie Owens had been divorced for several years when Merle came along, and the two of them became an item. They ended up all three being friendly to one another, and Buck, you know, didn't care who Bonnie was married to anymore. But the actual relationship between Buck and Merle, I think, was so complex because Buck had his own publishing company and signed Merle to his publishing company. So there was a business relationship there where every time Merle was making money, Buck was making money too. So that's always a little complicated with any relationship. And I think it was a case of they both wanted to like each other. I mean, it's really funny. But Buck says, you know, I tried really hard to be Merle's friend, but I just don't know if he really wanted me to. And he says, but the funny thing is, if you ask Merle the same thing about me, he'd probably have the same response. I do know that towards the very end of his life, Buck wrote a letter to Merle talking about how much, you know, Merle had meant to him. So I know that it's something that Merle was very proud to have happen. They were the last of those giants of the Bakersfield scene, and I know that there had to be some love between the two of them, as hard as it might have been for them to express.
Our guest today on Valley Edition has been Randy Poe. He is the co-author of the new book, Buckham, the autobiography of Buck Owens, a posthumous autobiography based on hundreds of hours of cassette tapes that the late country music icon made at his office in Bakersfield telling his story. It's available wherever better books are sold. Randy Poe, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, and Rebecca Plevin, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.